On this episode, I'm talking with James Ellis, an employer branding specialist. It's a very interesting interview, and it's a segment of branding that a lot of people don't know about or talk about at all. We have two types of customers, internal customers and external customers. The internal customers being your employees. And any scaling organization that's going to perform well into the future, better find the right employees that can help you scale your business. In fact, they'll just do it for you if you do it right. So I hope you enjoyed this episode and reach out to James for any other questions or insights or information on the subject that you might have. Thanks.
Employer branding is this weird subset of classical branding. So yes, I have an MBA. Yes, I went to school. I know my marketing. I don't know my four Ps. I know that a lot of people in employer branding don't really know all that stuff, but I do. I promise you I can play and I can hang. Employer branding is this tiny little facet of regular branding that says, look, everything is the same. The tools can be the same. The goals can be the same. The process can be the same, but there's this one teeny tiny difference. It seems so subtle, but it's right there. And that is, in the end, every dollar, every euro, every yen, whatever it is your particular, you know, client base is using, every dollar is a good dollar. But in my world, every candidate is not a good candidate. And so we think more intently on quality and not quantity, right? I get a lot of pushback from branders and marketers who say, oh no, we care about quality too. I'm like, no, you don't care. So long as the check clears, that's all the quality threshold you care about, right? If I had $1 million and said, I want to buy a jet engine and have it delivered to my house, you would do it, right? You wouldn't say, I don't know, James, where would you put it? And that seems like a zoning issue. You'd accept and cash the check like a good marketer or brander or salesperson would. But when it comes to hiring, it's different. You can't take, if you've got a role, you can't, you've got a great like VP of sales role, you can't put 20 people in it. You got to put one. So you better put the best one in. So employer branding is all about the idea that how do I help the people I want to hire choose us over all other employers? They've got virtually unlimited options. Why are they choosing us over other options? There's a million ways to do it. There's a million ways to think about it, but ultimately it's all about helping the person I want to hire want to choose me first.
Okay. So the job market has changed a lot. I remember 3 or 4 years ago, especially in technology, you know, people were begging for employees. Now it's kind of turned on its head a little bit, hasn't it? And looking ahead,
it's
what will
weird.
It is weird. Yeah. We also have the prospect of AI replacing jobs. A lot of companies may even need the help right now, but they're not hiring because they're kind of wait and see. So looking ahead, what will separate companies who thrive in, you know, talent competition from those who struggle just to fill roles?
Yeah. The thing is that for a long time, we used to think in terms of we need to put a butt in a seat. And that's not a pejorative term. That's how recruiters talk. That's just, hey, we got to fill this role. We got to put the butt in the seat. And if you were put a good enough person, a good enough butt, as it were, in that seat, you did a great job. You're right. The economy has changed. The economic political situation keeps changing. What companies want is changing. And what's happened is that not the companies want less talent. What they want is they want to maximize each slot. They want to make the best possible butt in each particular seat, as it were. What's happening is they're understanding that the stakes are really higher than they had planned or higher than they really thought. They used to just think, if I put a butt in the seat and I get the job done, it will achieve X amount of value. I can pay them Y amount of dollars. The math works out really easily. There you go. Today, we're starting to realize that businesses grow on the backs of its people. Who you hire determines your business's success. If you hire mediocre talent, you are going to have, at best, mediocre success. If you hire A-list talent, if you hire amazing talent who bring extra skills and experience and innovation and ways of doing things to your company gets better, your company grows. With all the AI stuff out there, we're realizing the AI is really good at getting mediocre thinking, right? It can make me sound like anybody I want, but it doesn't make me think like anybody I want. So what companies are realizing is that they have to invest more specifically in who they're hiring. They can't let every role just kind of be a slot filler. You have to say, we have to level up the talent. That means you have to express to someone why choose us over every other company, right? There's literally 20 million businesses in North America right now. Not all of them are hiring, obviously, and a lot of them are one or two person companies. But that means there's still like hundreds of thousands of companies that are hiring. Why are they choosing your particular company? And if you look at what companies are saying, they're starting to realize that this messaging of join us and we're hiring and great opportunity and great culture, which by the way, every company says all the time, and I don't know why, because it sounds like everybody else, it's not working anymore, right? It's like saying you should buy this Ferrari. It's got four wheels. Well, of course it's got four wheels. It's a car, but that's not why I buy a Ferrari. That's why I buy a car. That doesn't tell me why a Ferrari is different or better than a Volvo or a Mini. But the truth is those are three very different purchasing choices. And there's someone for whom each of those cars is the exact right choice. Cars are a great example because cars figured this out a long time ago, right? Cars are not about function. They are about fashion. They are about personal fit. They are about the experience. They are about who you are expressed as a person. We don't talk about, oh yeah, buy this car because it gets exactly this kind of gas mileage. That's a post-rationalized fact we use later to say, okay, this is why I chose it. You chose it because you saw that ad and you went, I bet I'm going to look really good in that car. Or you said, I'm going to feel really good about myself as a parent because I chose that car because it's the safest for my kid. Or you said, man, I'm going to drive this car and people are going to think I'm hot or attractive or whatever that thing is, or it's going to be fun to drive. There is an emotional component. That is where the recruiting model is starting to drift. They're starting to realize saying we have a paycheck and we have benefits isn't serving them. They sound like everybody else. Saying they have a great culture literally means nothing. What they're learning to do is to say, okay, what is that culture? How do we describe it? For whom is that an attractive culture? Because every culture is not good for everybody. Ask the people who work at, well, I'm not even name companies. Let's not get sued here, shall we? But there's plenty of companies who have horrible Glassdoor reviews and they still attract talent. Why? Because there's a certain percentage. There's a certain segment of the talent who says, that's what I want. For example, take SpaceX. SpaceX is a great company. We all know who owns SpaceX and we can less said about that particular decision, better. But SpaceX does not have a great Glassdoor rating. It's not well known for paying above the market. It's not well known for having a great culture. But if you care about putting man on Mars, where else are you going to go? That's your choice. If you believe in that mission so much, you're going to ignore the experience of working there and ignore the reward structure. If you don't have a mission, well, you better talk about your experience. If you don't have an experience, I guess you're going to have to pay for talent. And that is what companies are starting to grapple with, that talent truly has choices. And waving, work from home and we have a great culture in front of everybody isn't cutting the mustard anymore. And it's time to be more specific about what they offer, more specific to whom that offering is valuable, and connecting those dots more clearly.
Yeah. You mentioned a story about Goldman Sachs. Another story about when we talked before about Buffer and their public salary listings as these sort of extreme examples. Can you go into detail about those examples?
Yeah. So here's the thing. We'll use those examples to prove this idea, but the answer is, what do people want in a job? And the truth is they just want to know, what are we doing? How do we do it? What do we get when we do it? And everybody tends to over-index on one or two of those ideas. SpaceX is a great example. If you care about mission and that's the mission you care about, that's where you work. And you over-index on that mission over the experience of working there and the reward structure. There are plenty of people for whom how many nickels can I get out of this company is the sole decider, right? They're all about how do I maximize my income? And you look at a company like Goldman Sachs, who 2 or 3 years ago had a really ugly article written about them in the Washington Post. It was really a hit piece more than anything else. And it was all about, oh, all their junior analysts, they're working 100, 110 hours a week, and they're, washing themselves in the company restroom, and they aren't going home. They don't see their family. And everybody in my world said, oh my goodness, Goldman Sachs is going to have a real problem hiring people. No, they're not. No, they're not. No one worked at Goldman Sachs. No one chose Goldman Sachs because they liked the working conditions or because they had the great work-life balance. Everybody chose Goldman Sachs because the deal, the transaction was crystal clear. I, as the employee, will give you my 20s and my 30s. You, as the employer, will make me rich. End of conversation. There's no sense of, okay, and I'm going to, you're going to save the world and we're going to save the puppies and I'm going to have a nice work-life balance. It's none of that. It is money. You take all my time, I take as much money as I can. End of conversation. And what that story did, instead of saying, let's push people away, it became the proof of this idea that this is all a transaction. It's like, no, this is how hard you're going to work. But if I said, here's a job where you're going to make $200,000 a year and you're only going to work 20 hours a week, would you believe me for a second? No. You have to understand that in these roles, if I'm going to make that kind of money, I expect to work as hard as humanly possible. And the fact that here's proof that these people are working insane hours just makes it true that there's this transaction happening. And if I care about money, that's where I choose. So the game is not about how do I look attractive, because what is attractive, right? If you look at, people, there are Helmsworths and there are Kardashians and there's, Taye Diggs and there's gorgeous people, but there are plenty of people who are not gorgeous, who have no problem finding dates and no problem finding partners and have no problem. It's not that being unattractive works. It's that everybody wants different things and work is no different. So if you look at a company like Buffer, who is a really interesting company in that they're not very big and you may not have thought about them in a while. They did that social sharing kind of scheduling tool set, like back when Hootsuite or Sprout Social was too expensive. You went, okay, I'll just use Buffer for a while. They're a successful company. What they offer is transparency. You know exactly what you're getting into. You know exactly what you're doing. If you work there, you understand the entire lay of the land. You understand the entire kind of survey of what's going on. Everybody is completely transparent. Now, that's a nice thing to say. It really is. And plenty of companies love to talk about their transparency. That is very important that I say that. They like to talk about their transparency. Buffer said, let me prove it to you. And what they did is they published every employee's salary on their career site, on their public career site. Not, we're going to give you a PDF once you apply, once we know who you are. No, this is open knowledge. Everybody who works there, everybody who might want to work there now can see what the CEO and the entry level, whatever job pays. They know. If you care about transparency and everybody talks blah, blah, blah about transparency, you're going to work at the place where they show transparency, that this is all about a game of proof. And so you can make these nice claims and you say, oh, wow, we're the best. We're a wonderful place to work. Look at this wonderful award we have, or all these awards we paid for. Look at all these wonderful things people say about us, blah, 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 blah. What's the proof? And recruiting is now becoming a game of credibility and a game of proof. Everybody says lots of nice things, but who are you really? How do you prove it? And bringing the CEO out to say, yes, we care about the environment, isn't going to cut it, right? Bringing out the award that you paid for to say, look how good we are, doesn't cut it. Understand who you are and how you're specifically different. Your differentiated value, which for my branders, you get that completely. You take that differentiated value and you prove it. And you have to prove it far more from an employer brand standpoint than you'd expect, especially if you're, kind of trained in the consumer branding model where you say, I made a couple claims, boom, 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 Bob's your uncle, we're done. If you're buying a pair of shoes, you're buying a candy bar, the level of kind of the stakes are not very high, but when I choose my job, the stakes are incredibly high. That choice is a life-changing choice. So if I'm going to jump into your particular world, I want to have some expectation of what I'm getting into. And that requires a far higher threshold of credibility.
It's hard for a lot of people to imagine and look from within, okay, what is this that I'm supposed to be talking about?
Yeah.
How can a company do they have to develop this or?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's kind of a fight, a tension between create and uncover. And on a lot of levels, uncover is where you start. You understand, okay, what are the company's policies? Because every company is different. Some companies are all about their mission. Some companies are all about collaboration. Some companies are all about work from home and having freedom or having autonomy or having status or having support. Like, there's all sorts of things we offer. Here's an example. One of my clients, I was interviewing them and we're doing our process to kind of develop what their brand is, kind of understanding that differentiated value. And I was like 45 minutes into this conversation with two executives. And they're saying the same blah, blah, blah I hear all the time. And it's stuff like, oh, yeah, we really, it's really good people. People like to work here because we have really good people and we really like each other and we really support each other. And I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do here? That's the same blah, blah I hear from every company says they care about their own people, right? COVID really kind of reinforced that executives have to care about their people or at least have to say or show that they care about it, whether they care about it or not, separate conversation. But I'm terrified that I'm not going to figure out what this company's differentiated value is until one of them tells me this story offhand, like 45 minutes into the conversation. To me, this is the lead story, but they didn't realize how interesting it was or how important it was. They say, oh yeah, you know, we care about each other because, like, for example, I got sick 2 weeks ago and they DoorDashed dinner to my house because I was sick. And I was like, you sleeping on that one. What are you doing burying the lead there? That's the magic right there. That is a proof point because one, I've never heard of that before. Have you heard? I mean, has anybody heard of, you know, your company hearing that you're sick, canceling meetings, and they DoorDash you chicken soup or a meal or whatever is to me, hope, and, you know, saying, I hope you feel better? I've never heard that. And that's the difference between saying we care about our people and look at what we're doing to care about our people. And then we got into the conversation of the best way to prove that is to go into the CFO's office and say, give me your complete annual DoorDash, you know, receipts, like tally them up and say, hey, this is how much we care about our people. This year, we spent $147,000 on DoorDash for people when they were sick. Like that to me is like a lighthouse on a rock going, here's what I'm all about. It's proof. It's interesting. It's different. It's clear. It's like, I got it. I got what this company's all about. That is a wonderful moment. But the truth is, usually you kind of realize, okay, we care about credibility or we care about collaboration. Let's talk about collaboration because one of my clients, they work in biotech. And biotech's a really interesting space right now because it's not about the biology and the chemistry. Really, all the interesting stuff happens when you take the biology and the chemistry and you apply it to data science or engineering or something different. When you're really cross-pollinating biology and chemistry with other technologies and realizing there's so much more that can be done. So this company was, you know, we're talking about how much they cared about collaboration. You know, it took a little while to kind of pull that out and you go, okay, collaboration's a nice thing to say. But saying you care about collaboration is kind of like saying you care about supporting your people or you care about your people. It's a nice thing to say, but what does that mean? It's just a tagline. It's just a smile and a nod. What the heck does it mean? And what we ended up doing is we took that idea of your differentiated value was collaboration, and we had to construct structure and architecture around that to say, it's nice to say you're collaborative, but in this industry, kind of everybody is. Now, they weren't saying it, which is where our opportunity was. Everybody in biotech talks about how they're innovating and they're saving lives or creating positive patient outcomes, which of course is the reason you have a biotech. It's like saying buy the car, it has four wheels. It's the same idea. It's like it's the same blah, blah, blah. We talked about collaboration. I said it's not enough to just say collaboration because it's different. Now you have to prove it at a level that no one else does. And so we talked about, we care about collaboration, one, not because it's a nice thing to say, but because that's how our business grows. If we don't combine biotech or biochemistry and engineering, we're not collaborating and our business literally doesn't grow. Our business is built on the back of collaborating. Two, we work hard at collaborating. It's not something that just kind of happens. You actually spend time. We take classes. We talk to each other. We do debriefs. We do, you know, postmortems on how projects went so that we could better collaborate with one another. Three, we talk about this idea that collaboration is a means of professional development. Rather than taking a course on engineering, as a biochemist, you're going to stand side by side. You know, you're an expert at biology. You're going to sit next to someone who's an expert at data science or whatever it is, and you got to talk to each other. And you have to realize you have an opportunity to teach them expert level biology, and they have the opportunity to teach you expert level data science. That's professional development. It's not a class. It's not a seminar. It's interaction that forces development. You have to learn how to collaborate. Otherwise, you don't grow. And that became kind of their brand promise. We collaborate, and this is how it works in our favor, and this is how it serves you. So in that case, we kind of found the golden nugget of what was interesting and different about it, but we spent most of the time creating the structure to prove that idea. Whereas in the first example, once we had that story, we're kind of done. We just have to say that enough times, people go, I get it. In the second example about collaboration, you really had to kind of think through the architecture to make that claim clear and credible and useful.
Yeah, I can see exactly what you're saying. You in that use case, you have two examples of, well, here's the story. We just got to package this. And then the other exactly. one is, well, okay, we have the rough idea here, but now we've got to find the story.
You have to hone. You got to hone, you got to sharpen, you got to get clear. And that's the problem in my industry broadly, is that we kind of say these nice things. And there's a term called employer brand, and it's very endemic and it's a little hurtful, but also like 1,000% true. Like most employer brands are just so Pollyanna-ish and rose-colored glasses, and we're great. And it's bland, bland, bland. There's no differentiating value behind it. To get a brand that does and creates value, that helps your company grow, you got to sharpen it well past the bland stage, and that takes work.
Okay. And once you have this story, is that where somebody like you is done? Or it's hard for me to understand how this translates into job descriptions yeah. or resumes. How are we then advertising? Is this a PR blitz? Are we creating, you know, commercials? With this, are you developing an internal tagline? I've heard that term before. Mm-hmm.
So the soup to nuts of this process is you do research to understand your competitive set. You aren't hiring in a vacuum. You are hiring against 5 or 20 or 1,000 other companies. If you're a SaaS company in the Bay Area, you're fighting against 10,000 other companies, all of whom are SaaS companies in the Bay Area, and they all have free lunch and they all have good salaries and they all have the same set of perks. So you got to understand the landscape. You got to understand your competition. Then you got to define what's your position. How are you different, and hone it. And once you've established that and you nail it and you test it, and you make sure it's crystal clear and it's true, then you have to communicate it. And that means, how do you take that idea? So let's go back to collaboration. How do you take the idea of collaboration and put it on a career site and put it in a job posting and put it in social media content from recruiters? Can you or should you put it in interview questions? Yes. Should you put it in all the automated messages from your ATS? Yes. Should you put it every single place you can possibly create touch points? Yes. Now for me, very often, since I tend to work for smaller sub 2,000 employee companies, I bring a playbook and say, this is the 10 things you do day one. Let's go. And it's all stuff that they can do. Here's examples of job posting template changes. Here's how we rewrote your automated messaging. Here's some social content about how to announce jobs. Boom, 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 boom. Easy to do. Once recruiters get a hold of that, fingers crossed, they start to understand how to take this idea of the brand and use it for themselves. But from there, everything the company does around their people should connect back to that brand. That includes retention campaigns. That includes HR work. That includes announcements of new promotions. Everything should connect back. And so if you want to say your employer brand is really your people brand, I have zero problem with that reframing, because that's really completely fair. It's about, why do people show up? And why do people stay? Because the truth is, if you're hiring someone to show up day one, you really have to do that every Sunday. Because every Monday morning, if they got the Sunday scaries, every Monday morning, they make that choice. Do I show up? Do I reapply functionally for this job? Do I keep showing up, or do I start looking someplace else? So the more you can integrate it into your culture conversations, the way you process information, the way your company, you know, all hands meetings, all that stuff, anything internal and everything to candidates should all sync up. Now, where this really starts to create value is that you create this, let's just call it people brand for the moment, because I think employer brand gets stigmatized. Let's call it people brand, because the truth is, you're telling the story of why people choose you and what people get out of you and what people, the value people see in you. People, 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 people. Now let's imagine you're that SaaS company in the Bay Area, and you're talking about feeds and speeds, and you're slapping the words, letters AI on everything that moves, right? You're saying all the wonderful stuff, bells and whistles, to try and get people to buy. And that's your job, and I get that. And good, do that more. And if your company is saying stuff about feeds and speeds and AI this and AI that, like every other company, it's really hard to stand out. But what if I gave you a whole new set of colors these people stories to talk about, not about necessarily why this feed and speeds matter, but to say, these are the people who invented those feeds and speeds, and this is how they use it, and this is how they talk about it, and this is what they've learned from other customers. And you start to connect on an emotional level to this SaaS product. And very rarely do you say emotional level and SaaS product in the same breath, right? That doesn't happen very often. If you leverage the people brand, you tell the story of why people choose to work there, which is like this close to why people choose to buy there. In fact, you go back to PR comms. If you go to look at like crisis communications, Papa John's, guys are racist. They pull him off NFL. They pull him off this. They go, oh my God, his face is on every pizza box. What are we going to do? He's on every commercial. So what does Papa John's do? Well, they get rid of the face, meet all the people who own franchises in your area. You can't be mad at them. They're the ones making the pizza. They're not racist. They're wonderful people. They're delivering your pizza. They're leveraging the people brand to support the larger consumer message. Wells Fargo, naughty, naughty. Can't make those accounts like that. That's illegal. Some people should probably have gone to jail for that. Okay, well, let's not talk about the company and let's not talk about ethics. Let's talk about the tellers. Let's talk about the wonderful people who you'll interact with when you are a customer. Wells Fargo. This is how we leverage. People in the PR crisis comms space realize that when the chips are down, talking about the people is an incredibly powerful message. When you can't talk about the consumer, when you can't talk about the consumer brand, when it's tainted. So why not just skip past the crisis part and leverage those two to build a stronger brand, leveraging the people who show up, leveraging the leaders, leveraging the innovators. Johnny Ives is as much about the face of Apple for a long time as anything Steve Jobs was, wasn't he? Like, your iPhone is your iPhone, not because Steve, but because of Johnny. And he was an employee. Yes, super high level employee. And every year, Apple twice a year does a big to-do, a big reveal of all this stuff. And they bring out the executives who are in charge of these functions. Here's the executive in charge of the store, charge of software, in charge of whatever. They're trying to bring a people connection to their products, which are inherently unpeople-y. And that's what they're trying to do, is create more of that emotional connection, because that emotional connection sells long-term.
We can all understand the risk. It feels risky to tie a brand to anyone. I mean, founder-led brands like Papa John's or Gary Vaynerchuk or Alex Hormozy, well, it's the founder, so nobody really has a choice there. But then now you're talking about taking people in the organization. Is like, well, what if they do a bad post on social media? I feel like that's a little risky too.
Yeah, it does feel a little risky until, and here's when I make your sphincters kind of clench a little hard. I want you to go talk to your recruiters. You've got a team of recruiters at your company. And right now, they are doing outreach and they're sending messages under your logo. And when is the last time anyone has looked at what they said? And I'm going to tell you right now, never. They've never looked at what a recruiter says, because no one thinks about what recruiters are doing. And all day long, they send all sorts of messages. Heck, we give them CRMs so they can spam the heck out of people with this message, which may not align with what you care about. So if you want to talk about control, yeah, you don't got any, but nobody does. But the truth is, let's look at a company like Webflow. Now, Webflow is one of my favorite examples because I'm a consumer. There's my bias. I spend money. They run my website for me. I chose them because there's lots of companies that can help me make websites, right? I chose them because there was a guy who did all their documentation videos, and his videos were the funniest, most interesting, most compelling technical documentation videos I have ever seen. He set the bar. They were amazing videos. And I literally like this dude to the point where I follow him on LinkedIn. I follow his personal YouTube channel. Like, I have what feels like, in the same way a podcaster and a podcast listener has an emotional connection, I have an emotional connection to his world. He is the face of that company. I don't know many other people who work in that company. I know him. Yes, he can leave. He did leave. I think he's coming back. I don't know what the situation is, but that's a separate conversation. But yeah, there's always risk in that, but there's risk in everything. The alternate risk is to sound like everybody else and slowly wither away. That to me is the other side of that coin. That's where the other side of that bet is. So leverage your people. You can apply structures, you can apply guidelines, you can apply legal standards to what they are and aren't allowed to say. I've worked at a public company. I know what I'm not allowed to say inside a public company that changes the stock price, and that's the stuff that gets you fired and sued. They teach you that day one. If you teach your people that, let them talk about what's really like. In fact, the stronger your brand is, the more clear they go, oh, that's what I should be talking about. Oh, this is a company that's about collaboration. Let me tell my collaboration story. Not these other stories I could tell, which makes you nervous. Talk about what it's like to collaborate. What do you get out of collaborating? It's effectively creating this channel that you can trust because everybody understands what the rules are and everybody understands what they're supposed to talk about. Good and bad, because all of it's good, all of it's valuable. It's about credibility, not about making the brightest, shiniest penny. But more credibility and more clarity is how you start to win that fight.
And what is your opinion about founder-led brands like Gary Vaynerchuk and VaynerX? Gary Vaynerchuk does understands this concept very well. He's constantly talking about his company and its core values. I've never worked there, don't want to work there, although it would probably be pretty cool, but I can tell you what he values most.
We learn a lot, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'll change my statement. I would like to work there just to learn a lot. Yeah, that's true.
Send everyone, Gary. So the name is Jesse Mansfield. That's where you want. That's who you want to hire next. I'm just putting the plug in right now. Get it in the way. Yeah.
So his company, he has one particular thing he talks about all the time. You better be nice. There's no room for not being nice here. I do not want these hyper alpha sharks, you know, taking all the credit and being rude to their team and being nice to some people when they need something. I know his whole story, and he talks about it at length about you come to me. And in fact, if somebody's doing that and you don't come to me about it to let me fix it, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And we all know that story about going, not feeling like we can go to HR. You know, if I go to HR, I'm just getting myself in trouble. So this is a very strong employer branding thing. What is your opinion on founder led branding in this space?
There's a pro and con, as there are to all things. And the pro to a founder led company is that you don't have to go through the obstacles, the layers to say, what would legal say? What does HR say? Are we allowed to say that? Are we allowed to say that? Founder is the founder, man. They own the lion's share of that company, more than likely. They take on the lion's share of the risk. So they are in the position to be able to make that proper assessment of, is this the smart thing to say, right? So they have the ability to push, where a lawyer or an HR team might say, or a comms team might say, whoa, don't say that. Like, I'm going to blank on who it was. Open Door. Open Door did this big idea about, you know, they're getting in trouble. It's a social, you know, it's a tech company. And they had a big announcement that said, we have fired all of our PR teams. All of our PR is going through our CEO, because the CEO understands the company, understands the technology. There are no more kind of gatekeepers. There are no more intermediaries. You want to know what's going on? CEO will tell you what the CEO is allowed to tell you, but will answer as much of that as they can. And so the CEO and the founder is driving the PR. And that is something a PR team can't do, a comms team can't do. They simply can't get in the weeds at that level. However, it's one of those situations like where you say, a king would be great, if it's the right king, right? You can get a crazy despot and when you're in trouble. Like Elon Musk, good and bad, he's got that founder-led mentality, and we can quibble on the wording of founder there because it's not quite true, but he acts like a founder-led company on a lot of levels. He gets himself in trouble all the time. He's saying all sorts of stuff that make his employees scared to work there, make them nervous. So it is putting a lot of power in one set of hands. However, that one set of hands also bears the risk. So there's a pro and a con there. So you can use it the right way, and you can use it to say things that most companies can't. However, it's very easy to cross the line. It's very easy to break, to break into spaces that you don't want to inadvertently. So the other thing is that founder-led companies don't always stay founder-led. At some point, you sell the company. At some point, you bring in a new CEO, or you bring in new leadership, or whatever. There's a lot of companies, a lot of examples where you say the founder-led was growing and they pass the reins to somebody else, and that company starts to tank because it's not the same. If you put too many of your eggs in that particular founder's basket and the founder gets to leave or dies, you're going to have to build from scratch. There's no kind of transitionary kind of branding to do. It's like, okay, clean sheet of paper. We got to do it all over again, but we're building from nothing. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of time. So double-edged sword, to be fair. And if you have it, take advantage of it. If you can, if you can't, don't worry about it. There's still great work to be done.
Yeah, it does seem very risky. You're putting all your eggs in one basket. You have one spokesperson who's espousing and building a brand. And if something happens to them, you know, but
yeah,
there is this huge push about founder-led brands now. There's this risk element, all your eggs in one basket, but it seems to be the most efficient way to propel forward for most companies. And, you know, Elon Musk would, I feel like, is in the similar vein of Goldman Sachs. He's definitely saying, like, you're going to do important stuff here. You're going to work a lot, and I'm going to hold you to an extremely high standard, but you're going to get to work on very big things.
Pretty cool stuff. Yeah, exactly. And that's everything is a trade-off. Every job, like, think of the worst, most toxic company you have ever worked for. You're like, God, no one should want to work there. No. No one like you should work there. Every company has someone for whom it is a perfect fit. There is, in fact, a lid for every pot. Every company, you're like, you couldn't pay me enough money to make me show up there. There is somebody who is some Machiavellian, you know, manager who goes, toxic workplace, that's where I thrive. That's where I get to do my stuff. That's how I do my best work. That's perfect for them, not for you. That Machiavellian person would loathe having to work in your supportive environment because their Machiavellian stuff doesn't fly anymore. So there is a lid for every pot. So it's not about good company, bad company. It's about fit. And the problem is when companies communicate purely in a, we're a good company or we're a great place to be a workplace. And I won't say what the award is because we all know what award we're talking about, and it's all pay for play, what have you. It's easy to buy that award. It's easy to say that thing, but it doesn't mean anything. If you look at the list of people who have gotten that award, and by the way, that list is 10,000 companies long, you will see companies that have nothing to do with each other. Their culture is different. Their workplace is different. Their function is different. Their mission is different. Their experience is different. So what exactly is this award describing other than someone was willing to pay the money to get the award? It's not giving you information about what it's really like. It's not setting proper expectations. Does it mean you have a great mission? Maybe. Does it mean you're going to be supportive? Maybe. Does it mean you're going to have a lot of autonomy? Maybe. No one knows. It's just a award you slap on your career site. When you get good at this, you realize it's about being crystal clear about what makes you different. Every company pays their people. Every company has perks and benefits. Every company in America pays for insurance, it seems. Okay. Now what? What's beyond that? What's the thing that makes you different? Is it a mission? Is it experience? Is it work from home? Is it the level of support? Is it the level of status? Is it the work from home? Is it the work-life balance? What am I getting and how are you different from other companies? That is what a candidate wants to know because that is how a candidate makes a choice. It's not about good or bad. It's about what is the right choice for them. Because the truth is, when you get all the way down to the microeconomics of how this all works, candidates choose the company to work for to maximize the value to them. Value being measured far beyond salary. It's measured in support. It's measured in exposure. It's measured in culture. It's measured in any number of things, mission, connection, all that stuff, professional growth, professional development, all of those things, access to clients, access to, you know, really cool clients. They measure the total perceived value and weigh it relative to either where they work now or what the other option is. The truth is we've ignored the idea of the total value package and we focused either on salary or just saying nice things as if that means anything. Great employer branding, the kind that serves consumer brands, the kind that serves corporate brands, the kinds that grow businesses are all about making the value being offered to people crystal clear and the kind of value that people get to make choices on. That's how that happens.
Now you mentioned, we're talking about large businesses, large brands. Does this filter down to, at what point does a company need to start worrying about this and implementing this? And also, where does this live? I mean, we know that the CEO is over everything, but does this live in HR? Is this an HR and also, I guess I would imagine management generally across the board needs to be very briefed on this, but.
It's a good question, and it's a question that even within the industry, we don't have a standard for. So I'm going to answer the second question first, which is yes, it lives wherever it can live. And I'm a big believer that it is a process that straddles the line between recruiting and HR and marketing, but it doesn't necessarily have a proper place to live. I think of it in terms of if you've got a strong consumer brand, it should probably live in TA because it's just going to access the value being brought by the consumer brand and the marketing team. If you don't have a consumer brand, you want to live in the marketing team so you can add value there first and create value. Should management know about it? Yes. Should leadership know about it? Yes. Is it tying directly into how people perceive the company? Yes. But ultimately, there is no right answer as to where it should live. You know, in a perfect world, it's its own separate function, but I know no one wants yet another person or another team to report into them. So I don't say that. I just say, look, there is no right answer. Pick what feels good now. There's pros and cons on both sides. That said, to your first question of how, yes, we're talking about big companies. And honestly, employer brand was invented for big companies and how big companies do business and how big companies hire. It's designed around an economy of scale that most companies can't experience. You're not an AT&T, you're not a Boeing, you're not a SpaceX, right? You're not hiring 5,000 people a year. You're not Amazon hiring 125,000 people a year. You're like, what do I need this for? Well, my experience is if you think of employer brand as a big company thing that comes with a big company price tag, you're right. If you're under 2,000 people, you shouldn't buy it. You shouldn't involve yourself in it. Don't worry about it. But I think if you're hiring someone, the choice of why choose you is true wherever you work. If you're a two-person company looking to be a three-person company, if you're not hiring your best friend, and let's be fair, startups are usually in that model where they're hiring their friends and people they used to work with. It's a different conversation. But if you're hiring strangers, you need to have a clear reason why they should choose you over all their other options. And the typical standard way of doing recruiting, of writing a job posting full of bullets that talks about the company and not about the employee, that has a career site that just says how great they are, that has social media that just says we're hiring, you're not going to make that choice very clear. And if you think of the person you're trying to hire or would want to hire, and they go to LinkedIn or they go to Indeed and they go to a job board and they type in their job title and they go, they get the laundry list of the 1,000 companies hiring for that title today. Why would they ever click on your logo? Why? And if you can't answer that, you're in trouble. You need some help. So instead of talking about this employer branding terms, I generally talk about it in terms of messaging strategy. Hey, what's your differentiated value and how do we express it such that the person you want to hire goes, ooh, I haven't heard that before. I want to learn more. Gimme, gimme, gimme. Is that employer brand? Absolutely. But if we pull away all the stigma around big company thinking that employer brand is just for big companies and it comes with a big company price tag, it's really about understanding what makes you different and communicating that so that candidates can choose you over all the other options. So for me, if you're a company of 500 people, yeah, you should have an employer brand. You should have a reason why everyone should choose or why certain people should choose you over the other options. If you're a 2,000 person company, yes. It's just that the scale of what constitutes a brand, the level of research, the level of depth, what the threshold of value is shifts. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have a clear reason why people shouldn't choose you, because otherwise no one ever will.
Yeah. Excuse me. It seems like founder-led brands, again, for the win. If the founder is the face of the company espousing its values, this is done very efficiently and doesn't require much thought. Not many companies are like that. But I know a company in my industry, commercial printing, called the Taylor Corporation. And This guy started in the 70s, took over Carlson Craft, which was and still is a wedding invitation stationery company. And he's grown that immensely. He's a billionaire. He owns the Minnesota Timberwolves. And it's so interesting because they have this series on YouTube now where him and his core team that he grew the company with through the 70s, 80s, 90s, discuss their acquisition. So the big part of the thing was horizontal acquisitions. And they have stories about, we acquired this company and this is the story. It was nuts. And you really see who they are and what they think. He also says that very early on, he developed this idea that we're going to make acquisitions and moves in this industry with a rule of thumb that we are doing it. We're never going to do something that's risky, that's going to make us implode and have to do layoffs. And what was the other part? We're never going to do something that's too risky, and we're going to do acquisitions that provide opportunity internally so you can keep climbing a ladder. So if you work here, you're going to work hard, because we go in and we, you know, retool these companies and make them more efficient. That's our motto. So we really need you to be committed to this company. But if you are committed to this company, we're committed to you. We're always going to have enough work for you. So,
okay. So that's a great idea. And it's a great example of how talent strategy serves the company. So there's a whole lot of blah, blah, blah about strategy and culture and all this other stuff. And everybody talks a great deal about it. And most of the time they're saying nothing. The truth is, that is a situation in which the company had a strategy that says, we are not going to grow by vertically integrating. We're not going to grow by innovating. We're going to grow horizontally. Completely valid strategy. But that's what it is. It's a strategy. That is our strategy for growth. Okay. If we grow horizontally, it's very easy that as we buy companies, half the people leave. That kind of negates the value of buying those companies for the most part. Yeah, you're buying the book of business, but you're losing all the people who know how to serve that business. And if the more you do that, the more you're, you know, running up a steeper and steeper hill, you're spending more and more money to invest in, you know, to buy and acquire more companies, to have to spend more to keep people. And it's a really expensive way to live. If you tie your talent strategy to your business strategy. Hey, as we grow horizontal, it's imperative that we keep these people, which means the story we tell each company as we buy them is, this is not a, we're going to eat you like lunch. We're bringing you into a larger entity where you get to do your work, but you have greater opportunity to grow, become managers, to oversee and, you know, distribute, to be regional distributors, whatever that is, that is a talent strategy, a reason to join us. Remember, the reason you stay and the reason you join, same reason. So that's what they've done, is they've tied their talent strategy to their business strategy. And that's why it works. Too often companies just go, I came up with a business strategy, let's go. And you go, do you have the talent to make that strategy happen? Do they know what the business strategy is? Do you know how you're going to bring in the talent to serve that business strategy? No, you forgot to ask the CHRO and talent acquisition. Oops, you're in trouble. And then you get Xerox over and over again, having a brand new strategy every 3 or 4 years and going, oh, that didn't work. I wonder why. It's like, yeah, because you just made it up as you went along instead of thinking, how does the entire company serve the strategy? And in that case, every new person who comes on is joining a company that's growing, which means they're joining a company which their options are literally expanding at every acquisition. That is a clear reason to choose you. That makes perfect sense. And I love that example, even though, I mean, I'd never heard of this company before, and I'm not, you know, my commercial printing model is limited, to say the least. But that's exactly what's happening. They're merging their talent strategy and their business strategy to be one strategy. They're not doing one. It's like going to the gym and just exercising your right side. You got to do the both. Otherwise, your core will just collapse and, you know, you'll have the world's strongest bicep that doesn't do anything because you can't stand up straight.
Yeah, it's got to be integrated. Employer branding, recruiting, really getting the right people in your company is the most important thing you could probably do, because I don't care how effective you are as an individual and efficient as a CEO, you need people. And the best CEOs, that's their entire focus, is finding people that can carry the torch, who you can trust with your brand and with your customers, and you trust that they're aligned with your values. If that's all you did, and you did that well, people who are aligned with your mission and your brand, then you're going to succeed. You don't have to be the one coming up. Ideally, you're not having to come up with the new strategy. You're not having to come up with the new way to get XYZ customer. You're just finding the people who align with who you are, and then they carry the torch. And even if you are a founder-led brand with all the eggs in one basket like that, that is how you can grow a company and scale it truly.
Yeah. As companies hit a certain threshold, the CEO can't invent every new product. They can't invent every new feature. They can't invent every new marketing tagline. They can't be driving. Look, Hormozi is a great example because, let's be fair, he's got a small company. He's got a handful of people. He is the product, right? He just has to come up with another $100 million, whatever that thing is. Boom, it's a book. Boom, it's a video course. Boom, that's what he does. He's fine. That's what we're talking. We're not talking about, you know, educational products or anything like that. We're talking about SaaS companies or, you know, service companies or manufacturing. There's a point at which the CEO can't make every decision. And that is the threshold at which who you choose to hire determines your overall success. The truth is every company grows on the back of its people. The people who invent the products, the people who serve the products, the people who market and sell the product, the people who, you know, pack the person, the people who write the invoices and make sure the bills get paid. Those are the people who grow businesses. At certain point, the CEO goes, where is the business going? And they are focused on very different subjects other than where should the button go? Which is 2 years ago, that might be all they might have thought of for a whole day. What's the best place to put that button? As the company hits that model, even in a founder-led model, they have to relinquish authority to get stuff done. Now, the choice is, do you put it in hands of someone who just meets the bare threshold of what quality for that job is? Or do you hire someone who can push you, who is in fact better at knowing where that button should go than you ever will be? Isn't that how the company grows? And the answer is yes. As you level your people up, as people leave and you replace them with better people, that's how you grow a company.
Yeah, it's important to develop the DNA by which everything else works. Yep. I think this
that's how being clear on your culture helps. Yeah.
I think this is probably one of the most important topics, yet least thought about topics in a company.
My world.
Is there, if there was one thing that a CXO, a founder, a business owner could do immediately, is there something that they could do in this employer branding space?
Yeah. I'd ask the question, do you know why people choose you over other options? Not why you're good, not why you're nice, not why people could choose you, but looking at the other options they have, why would they choose you? Not everybody will. Not everybody should. And it's okay that you have competitors who offer different things better than you will because you offer different things better than they will. It's very much the, you know, do you choose a Ginger or a Marianne? Do you choose a Tay Diggs? Do you choose a Chris Hemsworth, right? There's options here. Not everybody wants the same things. So if you are the most or an only in that space, you can win. So to the CXO, I will say, look, your business is predicated on bringing in the people who grow the business. If that's correct, why are they choosing you? And if you're not crystal clear on that, and if you don't have a reason that aligns with how the business grows, you got to do some homework. You got to figure out and dive deep into what makes your company interesting, what makes your company different, so that you can tell that story and attract the people you really want to hire. Don't lean too hard on letting TA drive this conversation. TA is very good at saying, we just need to push out more jobs to more job boards and give me more tech and give me more tools, more ads and more emails. We've kind of walked ourselves into a cul-de-sac there, right? Does the world need more spammed emails? No. Do you need to get more emails on LinkedIn from recruiters? No. Is it working? No. So more of it will not. Instead, don't figure out how to be the most of something and the loudest of something. Figure out how you're different. That is your long-term strategy. And if you need help, there are people like me who can help you do that.
And how would somebody reach out to you, follow you, get more information on this topic?
I live on LinkedIn, not surprisingly. So James Ellis at LinkedIn, or so my company is Employer Brand Labs, employerbrandlabs.com. I run the world's largest repository of employer brand content and information. It's EB-AF, so EBAF.com. There's gotta be a dash in there. I don't know who owns EBAF, that's long since bought up, but it's thousands of articles and videos and podcasts and quotes and all sorts of ebooks and classes and all sorts of stuff to help you understand what employer brand is. And 99% of it is free. So check out eb-af.com. And yes, it means what it stands for, Employer Brand AF. That's what that's there for.
Well, thank you so much, James. And maybe we'll have you back on again in the future. I know there's a lot of stuff in the news and current events that stuff like this pops up. So I appreciate your time and thank you very much.
Thanks, Jesse. This has been a blast. Thanks for having me.